If you think our current energy system is destructive for both the environment and humanity, you could be excused for being pessimistic. Globally, greenhouse emissions are at an all-time high, and in this country, both Democrats and Republicans are embracing an all-of-the-above energy strategy that includes expanded production of oil and coal. But our guest today on Your Call, physicist and environmentalist Amory Lovins, says the big transition away from the dirtiest fossil fuels is already underway, and that private enterprise, civil society, and a dose of military innovation can make it complete by 2050 without action by Congress. Do you believe it? Bring your open mind and your skeptical questions to our conversation with Amory Lovins after this news.
BBC News with David Austin. As civil war rages across Syria, both sides say a school close to Damascus has been hit by shellfire, killing around 30 people, almost all of them children. Jim Muir reports from neighbouring Lebanon.
Both rebels and the regime agree that a school to the northeast of Damascus was hit by shellfire or mortars, but both accused one another of being responsible for what the state news agency called a horrific massacre, with almost all the victims schoolchildren. On virtually all sides of the capital, there were clashes and heavy bombardments as government forces battled to keep rebels from pressing in on the central core of the city, the seat of the regime's power. With the international airport now generally considered too unsafe to risk landing, Damascus is increasingly looking like a city coming under siege.
The head of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, says any use of chemical weapons by Syria would provoke a swift international response. His warning follows unconfirmed reports suggesting Damascus may be preparing such weapons as the civil war continues.
The possible use of chemical weapons would be completely unacceptable for the whole international community. And if anybody resorts to these terrible weapons, I would expect an immediate reaction from the international community.
Syria insists it would never deploy chemical weapons against its own people. Mr. Rasmussen was speaking at a meeting which, within the past few minutes, has approved Turkey's request for Patriot interceptor missiles to counter any threat from across its border with Syria. Egyptian security forces have fired tear gas as protesters broke through barbed wire outside the presidential palace in Cairo. Thousands of demonstrators have been converging on the area to denounce President Morsi and a new constitution, which is to be put to a referendum on December the 15th. They say it was rushed through by the president's Islamist supporters and doesn't offer sufficient protection for minority and women's rights. John Lyne is in Cairo.
I'm just back from the presidential palace, and they gathered in large numbers outside, and then they broke through barbed wire cordon and broke through police lines, and the police had to retreat, and they started firing tear gas to the police, obviously to keep the protesters out of the palace. We're hearing that the president has indeed left the palace, not abdicated or anything, but just left it presumably for his own security. So it was quite a dangerous situation there, a situation, by the way, that never happened during the whole of the revolution. I don't think we ever saw this kind of gathering outside the presidential palace or attempt to attack it.
A powerful typhoon has battered the Philippines, cutting a path of destruction through southern and central regions. Up to 40 people were reported to have died in a mudslide near an army patrol base that was triggered by torrential rain. More than 100,000 people were reported to have fled to shelters. World News from the BBC. Officials in the North Indian state of Bihar say they're investigating a move by a village council to ban women from having mobile phones. Jill McGivering reports.
Male members of the village council in Tupmani village in Bihar decided on Sunday to stop women in their community from using mobile phones. A village elder said that in recent months, six local girls had eloped with their boyfriends. The council decided that stopping other girls from using mobile phones might prevent further unsanctioned marriages. Their ruling is that from now on, married women caught outside their homes with a mobile phone would be fined about $40. Unmarried girls would be fined about $200.
An appeals chamber in The Hague has upheld lengthy prison sentences passed on two Bosnian Serbs found guilty of war crimes against Muslims during the Balkan conflict 20 years ago. The judges upheld a life sentence for Milan Lukic, who was convicted of killing more than 100 civilians. The verdict against his cousin, Sredoja Lukic, for aiding the crimes was also upheld, although his sentence was slightly reduced. From The Hague, here's Anna Holligan.
Milan Lukic, the former commander of the Avengers Serb paramilitary force, thumbed through a religious book as the judges delivered their verdict. They upheld the original decision, saying the court was right to sentence Milan Lukic to life in jail. When the original verdict was delivered, judges described Milan Lukic's crimes as the worst acts of inhumanity that one person may inflict upon others. He was notorious for locking women and children in houses, then burning them alive.
The Dutch football authorities are suspending all junior and amateur matches this weekend after the death of a linesman who was attacked by teenage players. Dutch prosecutors say they're preparing charges against three teenagers detained in connection with the attack in the city of Almere. Those are the latest stories from BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. After 6 days of UN climate talks in Doha, Qatar, negotiations about global warming and how to deal with it seem gridlocked. Developing countries, including China and India, now the first and fourth leading emitters of carbon dioxide, are calling on wealthier ones to commit to stricter, deeper, and more immediate cuts. Meanwhile, the U.S. and other rich countries have lowered expectations for the meetings and seem comfortable with the status quo where global carbon dioxide emissions are on their way to another record high this year. In the recently concluded presidential campaign, global warming was hardly mentioned. President Obama joined Mitt Romney in embracing an all-of-the-above energy strategy, including more oil and coal, the fossil fuels that have accelerated climate change. But our guest on today's Your Call, physicist and environmentalist Amory Lovins, says we can end our dependence on oil and coal without passing legislation in Washington, increasing subsidies, raising taxes, or even inventing new technology. He believes the impetus will come from what he calls our most effective institutions, private enterprise and civil society, sped by military innovation. What we need is at our fingertips, according to Lovins, if we just look at the problem differently. He says the U.S. can get off of oil and coal by 2050, and he's here today to lay out his vision for how it would happen and to talk with you. Amory Lovins is chair and chief scientist of Rocky Mountain Institute. He's an award-winning experimental physicist and has advised governments and major companies worldwide on advanced energy and resource efficiency, and he's the author of many books, including most recently Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Amory Lovins joins us on the line from Big Sur. Welcome to Your Call, Amory.
Nice to be with you.
And I definitely want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation as well at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment or question at our website, yourcallradio.org. As you listen to Amory Lovins talk about his vision for the future and the opportunities to switch away from the dirtiest of those fossil fuels, oil and coal, what do you think of his plans? What questions do you have? Do you think what he's saying makes sense, or do you have a different idea of how we move forward? So, Amory Lovins, I want to start by what may seem obvious to a lot of people, at least in our audience, which is, you know, what do you think the strongest arguments are for needing to fundamentally change away from this, the energy economy as we know it right now?
The way we are providing and using energy today costs about $5 trillion more than it should between now and 2050. It's emitting carbon that is uneconomic to emit, regardless of whether carbon is priced. Those CO2 molecules going into the air have a price tag on them called your fuel bill. We have a very dirty and insecure energy system, especially our electricity system, that needs to be refurbished anyway by 2050, so we get to decide what the new system's going to look like and whether it will have more or less risk of about eight kinds. Also, we are missing out on the biggest business opportunity in at least centuries, if not longer. It goes at least back to the Industrial Revolution, and that is the shift to healthy, safe, secure forms of energy to replace the way we now run advanced industrial economies, which is largely by digging up and burning about 4 cubic miles a year of the rotted remains of primeval swamp goo.
Now we have much better methods.
That's what fossil fuels are, ultimately, right?
Yeah.
And so when you say there's a business opportunity, I think a lot of people don't think about the crisis we're in as an opportunity. Really talk about how right now, how are we using oil and coal, and where do you see the greatest potential for using them more efficiently?
Well, about three-fifths of our mobility fuel, which is how we mainly use oil, goes to cars. And if we make the cars two or three times lighter and more slippery, they use two or three times less energy, they need a two or three times smaller propulsion system. They also get safer, by the way, because the ultralight materials absorb 6 to 12 times the crash energy of steel and can do so more smoothly. And when the propulsion system gets two or three times smaller, you can afford to electrify it because you need two or three times fewer of the costly batteries and fuel cells. So the revolutionary competitive strategy now emerging in the car business that takes every kind of risk out of that business is ultralight, slippery, integratively designed electric vehicles that can have all the attributes you want and indeed are better performing than today's. They cost about the same because their electric propulsion components are so much smaller. And the first two vehicles on this evolutionary line enter mass production next year from BMW and Volkswagen, both in Germany. There are some American efforts to catch up and pull ahead, and I think this country has everything it takes to do that if we get our act together. And by the way, it's a lot easier to solve the car and electricity problems together than separately, because when smart vehicles are exchanging electricity and information through smart buildings with smart grids, they're adding to the grid storage and flexibility that make it easier for the grid to accept varying solar and wind power. Those are the two main ways in which we'll displace the coal that is overwhelmingly used in electricity. But lest you think this is just theoretical, coal has already lost a third of its market share in the past 6 years to competition from efficiency, renewables, and gas.
And is that here in the United States or globally?
That's in the U.S., but a very interesting thing's just emerged this year in China for the first time ever. The coal-fired electric generation has fallen about 8% year on year as of, say, September. That's never happened before, except in case of a big natural disaster or holiday period. And the economy grew about 7 or 8% in the past year, which is slow for them but fast for everybody else. And yet the growth in coal-fired generation that they had in the first quarter this year was more than undone in the second and third quarters as efficiency and renewables started to take hold. And, of course, China is now the world leader in five renewable technologies and aims to be in all of them.
So let's just complete the picture of oil and coal use and where you see the opportunities for increased efficiency. So, because you're talking about how these two are linked, if cars become electrified, then this becomes a more unified problem than it is right now in terms of how we solve it.
Historically, oil and coal have had almost nothing to do with each other. Less than 1% of our electricity is made from oil. Less than 1% of our oil makes electricity. But as we electrify cars and light trucks, they do start to converge again. That's important. As I mentioned, to add distributed storage to the grid. So, for example, we found that even in the Texas grid, which is isolated, not hooked to the rest of the country, you could run entirely on renewable electricity without bulk storage of electricity if you properly diversify, forecast, and integrate those resources using two kinds of distributed storage. One is in smart charging and discharging of electric vehicles, and the other is ice storage, air conditioning, which is straightforward and on the market.
So, Amir Levin, I'm sorry, you got to explain that for me. The distributed storage you're talking about. I'm just trying to imagine what that actually means.
Oh, that's the batteries in your electric vehicles, batteries or fuel cells, and they're there in order to move the vehicle, but your vehicle is moving only 4% of the time.
So it'd be plugged into the grid when you're not driving?
It can be, because you often park in habitual places. And also, when you're charging it, you can charge it in a smarter way. There was an interesting experiment recently in Delaware where Willett Kempton showed if you vary the charging rate in response to a signal from the grid in order to help regulate the grid very rapidly, then you can get paid about $7 to $10 a night for that service provided to the grid, and that's more than the grid charges you for the electricity you're using to get your car all charged up by morning. Now, you were asking how electricity and oil are used. That's where they're similar. They're in their concentration. Three-quarters of our oil fuels mobility, mainly light vehicles, and the rest of it almost all heavy trucks and airplanes, and those two can both triple their efficiency. And similarly, three-quarters of our electricity runs buildings. The rest runs industry. So to save both oil and coal, and for that matter, natural gas that can displace both, we need very efficient vehicles, buildings, and factories. And that's why in our kind of grand synthesis, Reinventing Fire, we integrated all four energy-using sectors, transport, buildings, industry, and electricity. And we found a lot of synergies between them. So in buildings using three-quarters of the electricity, we found that the energy efficiency or energy productivity of America's building stock could be tripled or even quadrupled by 2050 with stunning economics. It would save $1.4 trillion net present value. And the savings are worth four times what they cost. If any business folks are listening, I should mention the internal rate of return is 33%. And in industry, we can roughly double our energy productivity with a 21% internal rate of return. Now, it's a big job to do all that, and we have to bust a lot of barriers, but we have time to do it. And in order to achieve those results by 2050, we would just have to raise the national average adoption of energy efficiency to the levels that the Pacific Northwest has already achieved.
Amir Lovins is chair and chief scientist of Rocky Mountain Institute. He's an experimental physicist, has advised a number of governments and major companies worldwide on energy and resource efficiency, and he's the author of the new book, Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for the New Energy Era. Amir Lovins is laying out his idea of how the United States could get off of oil and coal by 2050. And Amir, you were just inviting people who run businesses, and I'd also invite people who work in alternative energy who've tried to think about how to make changes so that we have an energy system that is more environmentally and economically sustainable. I'd invite them to join the conversation, tell us what you think of Amir Lovins' ideas, and bring forward your questions. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Amir Lovins has really focused on market-based solutions and what civil society can do around these changes. Be interested to hear if you think that without significant government intervention, we can make this transition away from the dirtiest fossil fuels.
Let me pick up on the without
do.
Significant government intervention.
Yeah.
It's true that our approach wouldn't require new federal taxes, subsidies, mandates, or laws. However, there are quite a lot of policy changes needed. For example, rewarding utilities, as California does, for cutting your bill, not for selling you more electricity. What are called feebates, that's a fee on inefficient new cars paid for by rebates, paying for rebates to efficient new cars. So that people can take a long view, as society does, of what efficiency is worth when you're buying a new car. However, it turns out all of the needed policy changes can be done either administratively or at a state level. So that's why we also say no act of Congress required.
And I'm kind of assuming you think that there's more political possibility for those things happening closer to the ground.
Yes, and indeed California is the national leader in this regard. And also, by the way, Texas is right up there with a more or less a fair approach. For example, if you're making your own electricity and you interface your device with the grid through an inverter that is on the approved list, meaning it meets all of the health and safety requirements like Underwriters Labs, National Electric Code, and IEEE, you don't have to ask or tell your utility. You can just plug and play and start generating and running your meter backwards. And that's a very good approach that I hope all states will adopt. It was brought in by Governor Bush, actually. And Texas is, for example, the national leader in wind power, not because the state government is environmentally minded, but because there's a lot of folks there that are good at making money.
Amir Levins, I want to get to a number of calls we have at 866-798-TALK. Before we get there, though, I just want to kind of ask, there's certain kind of choices that, say, an individual can make. I'm going to invest in an electric car. I know over a long run that might save me money. Or I'm going to put solar on top of my house. I think ultimately that's going to pay for it. But changing these kind of large infrastructures of the electric grid, or, say, big commercial buildings where you have different incentives for the people who own the building versus the tenants that might rent them, There's some conflicts there. How do you break through those to make it so people can have that long view?
Mm-hmm. Each of those is indeed an important obstacle. Each has solutions, and this takes relentless patience and meticulous attention to detail. But we're starting to get there. For example, New York has on-bill financing for efficiency. 32 states have PACE bonds for commercial buildings, and did for residential till a federal regulator blocked it, and that'll have to be fixed in Congress. But the PACE bonds mean that any commercial building owner in those states can get these PACE bond financings to fix up the building to be very efficient with a positive cash flow from day one. And it's all a voluntary private investment program, no government intervention, except that the financing is actually run through the property tax system, so the obligation goes with the title, and if the property is sold before the loan's paid off, it doesn't matter. There are also pioneered in California things called efficiency service agreements. This is like the power purchase agreements that finance most of the solar power these days, where the developer putting up the project sells the power in advance to a utility or other party that's going to pay a certain price for it, and that makes the project financeable.
Finances that investment.
Yeah, and now we're starting to do the same thing with agreements to save electricity in a measurable way. And that's a very powerful innovation because it means a lot of little savings can be financed in big chunks at low cost and then add up to a shrinkage of electricity demand rather than just stabilization.
Amir Levins, let's go to our callers who are on the line. Brian in San Francisco, thanks so much for joining your call. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask your opinion of hydrogen-powered internal combustion engines. I've always been frustrated that hydrogen fuel cell vehicles always seem to be about 10 or 20 years away. But I've seen prototypes of Ford manufactured or Ford prototypes of hydrogen compressed gas internal combustion engines, and I'm wondering what is the feasibility of taking solar and wind, using that to split water into hydrogen and oxygen, compressing it into canisters and running internal combustion engines on that for transportation.
You'll have quite a lot of good information on hydrogen both in our book Reinventing Fire and in a paper at RMI.org called 20 Hydrogen Myths, M-Y-T-H-S, that we put out in Aught3, and it's still a kind of industry standard white paper. In brief, if you're going to go to the trouble of making hydrogen, it would be a lot smarter to use it in a fuel cell than in an internal combustion engine. It is perfectly feasible to do adapted engine designs that are optimized for hydrogen, but you'll get much higher efficiency in a fuel cell, and contrary to your impression, they're far off. Honda has had a test fleet on the road in California for some years now, and they're going to hit the market from a number of manufacturers a lot sooner than you might think. General Motors did excellent work in getting the cost down to even less than we assumed in our analysis. It's in the low 40s of dollars per system kilowatt, everything from the filler cap through the DC going to your motors. And that's a very high production volume, but our book lays out a clear competitive strategy and production pathway to get there rapidly by taking most of the cost and, excuse me, most of the weight and drag out of the car first, take the obesity out of the car. Then the fuel cell gets three times smaller so you can afford it, and the hydrogen tanks get three times smaller so they fit and you don't need any breakthroughs in storage.
Samuel Levins, just when I hear you talk about the development of the electric car and the potential for that, and then I hear Brian ask this question about hydrogen-fueled automobiles, and I just wonder, those are two major changes in our infrastructure that would have to happen to make those possible, right? When we've already got this kind of, you know, petroleum-based infrastructure, does it make sense to try to choose one of those paths when it comes to automobile transportation?
Oh, I think we'll end up with some unknowable mixture in automobiles of electricity, hydrogen, and advanced biofuel. Any of those will work fine economically and technically. Each of them has sound infrastructure solutions, and you don't need to pick. They both make sense. They both make money, singly or in combination. And the biofuels would actually mostly go to run trucks and planes, but the most biofuel we might end up needing is only about 3 million barrels a day, and you could get two-thirds of that from waste, and you could get all of it without using any cropland or endangering soil or climate. On the contrary, you pay farmers and ranchers for taking carbon out of the air and putting it back in tilth where it belongs. We published a hydrogen infrastructure solution back in 99, and it turns out to be remarkably cheap. If you adopt the distributed approach of making hydrogen typically from natural gas at the filling station in what's called a four-quart reformer, and those have been developed already quite a few years ago with very good economics, you can also make hydrogen in centralized ways, like when we aren't buying the oil anymore, you'll have a lot of surplus centralized production capacity for hydrogen at refineries, and they could sell it over the back fence. There are now some better ways to distribute it, but the distributed generation of hydrogen, whether from gas or electricity, is typically cheaper than the centralized delivery.
I want to bring Greg in Palo Alto into the conversation with Amory Levins. Welcome, Greg.
Hello. Just a couple of questions. I'll turn my radio down here. Sorry. One is the focus, much of the focus of this conversation has been on the automobile. And I'm wondering why, I don't foresee in the very near future any great change or direction in change in terms of the use of transportation. But it seems to me that somehow, especially in large urban areas, the real solution is to get away from the automobile. Not only is the energy issue a big issue, but look at all the materials that go into the manufacturing of automobiles.
So that's your first question. What's your second question?
The second question is, I live in Palo Alto, in the heart of Silicon Valley. There's no reason that my city shouldn't be covered, plastered wall to wall with the kind of technology that Mr. Levins is talking about, and I can guarantee you it's not. We should be producing energy from solar, it seems to me, in Palo Alto, and not only are our government buildings not covered with it, I would venture to say that less than 20% of the housing, and that would be a extreme, have alternative energy. So I'm not as optimistic as Mr. Levins is about the change. So that's my comment.
Great questions. We're going to get a response from Amory Levins for you after we go to a break. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on Your Call. We're talking to Amory Levins, experimental physicist, environmentalist, director of Rocky Mountain Institute, and we'll be back with your questions and calls after this break.
Every Tuesday, the Your Call team sends out the weekly email newsletter. Helps you to keep up on what's coming up on the show and gives you resources, letting you learn more and get involved. Subscribe today so you'll know what's coming up and you can submit your questions and comments before the show goes to air. It's free and easy to sign up. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. We also invite you to participate in today's show by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about the use of drones by the U.S. military. Is there a right way to use drones, and what are the limits? Should the drone program be reconsidered or eliminated? On Thursday, we're going to be talking with Nina Simon, author of The Participatory Museum, about how museums are transforming themselves to become more interactive and engaging. And on Friday, it's our weekly media roundtable. We're going to be joined, among other folks, by Andrea Seabrook, former NPR Capitol correspondent. Today, we're talking to Amory Lovins about his vision for the U.S. ending its use of oil and coal by 2050. He is an experimental physicist and environmentalist, director of Rocky Mountain Institute. And I want to let folks, especially in the Monterey area, know that this upcoming Sunday, the 9th of December at 6 p.m., Amory's going to be speaking at the Monterey Institute of International Studies on a panel with some other folks talking about the future of energy in the United States, the role of renewables, microgrids, electric vehicles. That's 6 o'clock this Sunday. You can find more information at our website, yourcallradio.org. And I should say it is a benefit for our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz, which carries Your Call. So, Amory Lovins, let's come back to you. We got a lot of folks on the line, so I want to keep moving through them. But Greg in Palo Alto had two separate questions. One, simply, should we be reconsidering the automobile period, especially in concentrated areas, urban areas? And second, at the local level, why, you know, a city like Palo Alto, so innovative, so forward-looking in so many ways, why isn't solar everywhere?
Yes, of course, we should be encouraging and in some cases rewarding real estate developers for helping people be where they want to be so they don't need to go somewhere else. But it turns out when you do that new urbanist or smart growth layout, the developers make more money. It's a better way to live. You have happier families and stronger communities. And there's a remarkably strong evolution in this direction in the real estate community in many parts of the country, including California. And that's where some of the pioneers in this were, like Village Homes in Davis, which now has many imitators.
And is there evidence that it's reducing automobile use?
Oh, yeah, quite dramatically. And at the same time, with smart information technology developed in your part of the world, you can also encourage car sharing and ride sharing that gives an extraordinarily large reduction in the number of cars on the road to provide the same mobility services, because again, cars are 96% idle on average, and not everybody needs to drive at the same time. We can also use IT to make traffic free flowing and to enhance public transport. But designing our communities around people, not cars, is a very important change. And more fundamentally, letting all ways to get around or not need to compete fairly, instead of having socialism for cars and free enterprise for other modes. Now, this takes time because it's taken us decades to build the land use patterns we have.
We've made a big investment in this setup.
Yeah. But that changes every day with the investments we make a piece at a time, and we can make them in smarter ways. So we've gotten into this mess with millions of not very smart individual choices, and we can get out of it with millions of smarter choices, whether in buildings, land use, or anything else. It's just like the electric grid. We have to rebuild it anyway by 2050. We are rebuilding it day by day. Let's make the right choices to get an affordable, clean, safe, and resilient electric system instead of a inefficient, insecure, dirty one that we have now. And the second question was about...
We're talking about, really forward-looking, apparently, city like Palo Alto, where there's so much innovation. What are the obstacles to making it happen there at the local level? People could put solar panels on all kinds of things, right?
Yeah, and indeed, you're in one of the states where four companies, at least, will happily put solar power on your roof with no money down and generally beat your utility bill. And in a few years, all the states will have that.
So if that's in place, I guess Greg's question is, so why isn't he seeing it?
Well, I do see quite a few driving around Silicon Valley, and if I don't see more, it may be because people are so busy inventing the next widget that they haven't had time to
thought
about
how it's going to need electricity for it. Yeah,
but there are many places where I see these all over the place, and they're not always the places you'd expect. There's also some specific local barriers to overcome in any particular place. I was with a lady in Silicon Valley not many years ago who had just put the first roof-integrated solar power into her house. That is, the solar collector is the roof. It isn't something tacked on top of the roof, so you can save money on the roof structure that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the PG&E folks were... there to see it. They'd never seen one before at that time. And then the building inspector came with his clipboard and said, I heard you had something solar. I'm here to make sure it doesn't leak. And the lady said, no, it's electric. Of course it doesn't leak. He said, no, it says right here in my little book, if it's solar, make sure it doesn't leak. So they went and called the head building inspector who said the same thing. So they showed the inspector it had no pipe so it couldn't leak, and he was happy and checked it off and went away. This is in one of the most technically sophisticated parts of the world. So
it's a constant.
There are always some elements of the whole design, build, run process that are a little slower getting the message. And we do have thousands of building code jurisdictions in the country. We have several thousand utilities. They all have different rules, and especially in Palo Alto, which, am I right in thinking it has a municipal utility?
Too bad we don't have George on the line. I'm sure he could answer that for us, and maybe he can drop us an email.
You would have great opportunities, both through private enterprise and through community organizing, to get the kind of energy system you want.
Well, I want to make sure that listeners know that they can join the conversation with Amory Lovins at 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. What do you think of his vision for getting the U.S. off oil and coal by 2050? Do you believe it? Is it credible for you? And what kind of questions do you have?
I should add, it's not just my vision. This Rocky Mountain Institute book, Reinventing Fire, is actually co-authored with 60 of my colleagues at Rocky Mountain Institute, with a lot of help from industry on both content and review. A
lot of brains behind the work. But you're the lead author, so people give you the credit. And I'm just also really interested in people who have considered bringing solar into their homes or businesses. Do you think that market-based solutions can get us where we need to go and what the role of government is? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's what Claire in San Francisco did. And Claire, welcome to your call.
Hi. Recently, I read a book called The Watchman's Rattle. And in it, hello?
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. There was a chapter about NASA. And in one of their lulls, not inventing something or building something, they went into the area of the question of solar energy. And they realized, or they said, that the best way to get energy into the onto the Earth was to place something between the sun and outside our atmosphere, right? So they invented something. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but I think this is what I read. They invented something that would possibly give the whole world free electricity. I don't know technology, so I don't know what that something was that they posited, but they went to the energy department for 10 years, knocking on their door, and were turned away, and finally went to the Canadian government, who was interested in their proposal.
Amory, any idea what Claire's talking about here?
What's the book called again?
The Watchman's Rattle.
I don't know the book. Peter Glaser and others have for decades promoted the idea of solar power satellites, which is to put big solar cell arrays in orbit, like the little ones that run satellites, but enormously bigger, and then beam the energy to Earth via microwaves, collect it in giant antennas, and then put it into the grid. It's not free because it costs so much, not just to buy the cells, but to put them in orbit. And in general, if you had the cheap solar cells that this posits, which increasingly we do, they work better on your roof, even in Seattle, than they would in orbit, because getting sun 23 hours a day in orbit and getting stronger sun because it doesn't have to come through the atmosphere is not worth the cost of putting it in orbit.
In relevance, I mean, Claire's question kind of goes to something broader, which I think is the idea that, you know, a lot of people think, you know, some of these technologies that would really take us away from oil or coal, these, you know, our kind of current energy system, that there's incentive to, for those industries who are quite powerful politically, to essentially deep six them or to find ways to make it difficult for them to develop. How much credence do you give to that way of thinking? I think of, you know, the electric car is one of those things many people say, hey, here were these early attempts at doing that that then got delayed or got killed. What do you think?
Well, as a member of the National Petroleum Council, I should tell you, having, you know, worked in the oil industry 39 years now, I think the industry split down the middle. There are still some elements of the industry that are trying to block the shift to renewables every way they can think of, and through propaganda campaigns. There are others that are investing heavily in it, and it's part of their core strategy, because oil, like airlines, is a great industry but a bad business, and it has very unpromising long-term fundamentals. So the smarter companies have been changing their activities and their portfolio of options. Same in the gas industry, which is quite distinct. Same in the electricity industry. California happens to have some utilities, both public and private, that have often been very forward-looking and are getting more so. And it's there are a lot of tough issues along the way. Let me pick an obvious one. if I'm the utility and I charge you for electricity by the kilowatt hour, but you follow the emerging California standard of zero net energy houses that don't use any more electricity than they create over the course of the year, what am I going to charge you for? We are exchanging various valuable services back and forth for which we both need to be compensated. But if we treat electricity as a commodity and charge by the kilowatt hour, I go broke, you don't get the service you want, so we have to figure out how to treat electricity properly as an infrastructure and properly cost these services in a completely new revenue and business model. So actually Rocky Mountain Institute has an effort that's meeting right now called ELAB, Electricity Innovation Lab, to figure out this next industry by rapid learning among a wide range of stakeholders. So It's an exciting new time, and I think you may be surprised that the foreword to our book, Reinventing Fire, forewords are written by the president of Shell Oil and the dean of the American electricity industry, who was then chairman of the largest nuclear and third largest coal-fired utility in the country. Not because they agreed with everything in the book, but because they felt it was a helpful discussion starter, you know, an introduction to an honest conversation about where the opportunities are, and they felt that it spoke to the strategic needs and interests of the energy industries.
I want to bring Lawrence in Berkeley onto the program. Lawrence, welcome to your call.
Yes. Hi. Good morning, Mr. Lovins.
Hi.
You know, I agree with everything you say about where we should go in terms of cutting down polluting energy, but if you think that it can be done by individual choices and by corporations and market forces, you're being really naive politically. I mean, just to give a couple of examples, one is that Obama has raised the fuel standards for cars to 55 miles per gallon by, I believe, 1925, and the Republicans have fought it and promised to repeal it. Another is that, you know, as we've said before, we need a lot more mass transit so that people don't have to take cars. Well, Republicans fight mass transit and fight the money for it. And it's very simple why. Because, the oil companies, who are incredibly powerful politically, need to sell as much oil as possible. And if cars double their mileage, they sell half as much. And it's the same with mass transit. It's the same with coal. If every time there's a regulation to make coal less polluting, as the Democrats have tried to put in, the Republicans are against it. So the point is that it may be that eventually individual choices and market forces can change this around. But with the political opposition that is being fed by the coal and oil industry through the Republican Party and through, well, a lot of conservative Democrats too, they can slow it down enough so that it's going to come in much, much too late. We don't have the time.
Let's see. Let's get a response from Amory Lovins. Lawrence, that's a great question.
Yeah, I think you're assuming that we all have to wait for Congress to tell us what to do and that we'll only do what is mandated by new national laws. I don't think that's the way it works at all, or has to work at all. And California is a good example of this. It has the nation's leading suite of energy policies on both efficiency and renewables, without help and often with opposition from Washington. And many communities in California similarly have leading roles, like Sacramento, through its municipal utility. To pick your specific examples, we're looking at 125 to 230 mile a gallon equivalent autos in 2050, not driven by standards, but driven by customer demand and hyper competition, because the business model for those kinds of cars has much less risk and 80% less capital cost for production than today's automaking. That's why the automakers are so interested in it, and many of them have made very large commitments in that direction. So watch this space. I was a senior advisor to Bill Ford for a few years. I'm very pleased with what's happened there. Watch them. Watch a number of others. It's quite an exciting time. And we've actually just finished a big meeting in Detroit to help that industry adopt carbon fiber composite part making a lot quicker.
But, Amory Lovins, just to follow up on Lawrence's point, when it comes to moving the car industry broadly, something like fuel efficiency standards, that has a huge impact, right? That clears a lot of space.
Yeah, and they favor those standards.
They favor, but to Lawrence's point, and I guess what I'm asking is you're kind of, the way you're presenting the issue is to say, let's really, the real hope here is for, if there's going to be any kind of government intervention, it's closer to the ground. And otherwise, let's really look to market forces, civil society to make these changes
happen.
Yeah,
but happen. Look, Exxon already agreed in 2009 that U.S. gasoline use peaked in '07 and has nowhere to go but down. There's about a dozen reasons for that.
But there's still political forces fighting those fuel efficiency standards that President Obama is pushing.
There are some on ideological grounds, and there are groups doing good work to defend the standards, but frankly, that's not what we do. We help the industries involved find a way to make more money at less risk and provide better service at lower cost without needing government intervention, without getting embroiled in political disputes. Because what we're proposing is highly trans-ideological. Whether you care most about profits and jobs and competitive advantage, or about national security, or about climate protection and public health and environmental stewardship, reinventing fire makes sense and makes money. And I think just doing an end run with our effective institutions around the gridlock Congress is a very good way to get back in the driver's seat in the global energy revolution. Because what I've described is going on around the world. I'm just back from a couple of months in Japan, China, India, elsewhere in Asia, and the reinventing fire approach is oozing up through the cracks very nicely all over that region. India is at a tipping point away from coal. They've canceled 42 billion watts of coal plants since March. Japan is awakening to its enormous efficiency and renewables potential, and they've started a gold rush in renewables. China is, in many ways, the world leader in renewables, and driving enormous drops in world prices for solar and wind. China isn't doing this sort of thing because a treaty made them do it, but rather because they realize that otherwise they can't afford to develop. So energy efficiency, since 2005, has been their top strategic priority for national development. And in the Party Congress just now, they used very unusually the word energy revolution as the core organizing process for the next Chinese economy.
So, Amir Levins, we have just a few minutes left. I want to make sure to bring in some of our callers. So we're going to bring a few of them in and then get responses from you at the end of them. John in Santa Cruz, if you could be brief, go straight to the point. We want to make sure to get a number of folks on here.
Yeah, thanks. My point was similar to the last caller. An example you mentioned in Palo Alto, people might be too busy making widgets to be able to put solar panels. That seems an example to me of profits might make it the market forces might make it possible to finance this stuff, but I don't know if they're going to make it probable to finance, because there's other things that I don't think profits necessarily line up with the public good. That's all.
See, and you want to know about the role of public finance. Okay, John, great. We'll get an answer in a moment. George in San Francisco, welcome to your call. What's your question or comment?
Hi, Amory Lovins. We're dying to ask you, what, if anything, does this have to do with the reputed smart grid, the smart meter, the electric meter hype in California is that we should all install or have installed digital readout meters that chart our consumption of energy?
George, we'll get a response in just a moment. I want to bring one more caller on who says he has an answer about why Palo Alto doesn't have as much solar as it might. Michael in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi. SFenergymap.org lists the penetration of solar in San Francisco visually. Great map. The other thing is Palo Alto has its own energy source. They generate their own utility, and their energy is cheap enough that it doesn't pencil out. I sell solar. And the other thing, their planning department takes 6 months to get a solar job finished in Palo Alto.
Right.
Most solar companies don't bother. That's all.
All right, and you work in the industry. Thanks so much for that call, Michael. And one more from Berkeley. We have a call from Shlomo. Shlomo, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you. Yes, I would like to know from your guest, what policies he would recommend to make, for instance, solar much more available to the mass of people. Because it seems to me that until you make it solar, for instance, and other cheaper energy sources and technology, unless you make that substantially cheaper and substantially more available, you will not get a great change. For instance, if you were to make solar, instead of being a process where you have to hire a contractor and so on, you have to hire this expertise at great amount of money, and then you don't actually start making money, so you don't actually pay it off for years down the road.
Shlomo, let's get a response from Amory Lovins, and then we'll come back to some of the other questions as well. What kind of incentives will work for solar?
Well, there's currently a 30% federal tax credit that's good to 2016, and on that basis, even not backing out the often larger subsidies to non-renewable electricity, solar actually competes nicely. This April, in the California auction, there were over 4 billion watts of successful solar bids that can beat a new combined cycle gas plant on price. And the price continues to plummet as we wring out inefficiencies in the delivery system. And the proof that that works is in Germany, where they've really gone to scale. They put in more solar cells last December on rooftops mainly than the U.S. installed all last year. They put in 3 billion watts in a month, and they're doing 7 or 8 billion watts a year. So their installed system cost for solar power is only half what it averages in the United States. The caller about installers not bothering with communities that have very difficult time and money-consuming permitting is absolutely right, and we've actually helped drive that differentiation by working with folks in the industry who are now publishing a guide to how long it takes to get your solar permit in each community in California, because it's different by town and by county, in order to kind of shame the laggards into getting efficient. In Germany, you fill out one or at most two forms of about a page. In California, you can have over 20 different forms, some of which are practically a book. So, yeah, there are a lot of self-inflicted obstacles here, and the installers are really busy because solar cells have become quite competitive with your solar retail with your utility retail rates. So they'll go where it's easiest, and other communities will be left out, and citizens in those communities will have to use some political pressure to get a modern approval system. But we are in the course of cutting in half the non-module cost, the other half so-called balance of system cost of installing solar power. Competition is driving that very, very rapidly, much faster than most people would have thought. And the financial innovations, the power purchase agreements and efficiency service agreements are helping that along. As soon as we can get legislation to fix the federal regulatory hold on residential PACE bonds, that will get the household financing back on track. And I think the other thing that's going to accelerate solar installation is Hurricane Sandy.
It's getting people thinking in some different ways.
Yeah, getting people to realize that we need a resilient electricity system where cascading blackouts are impossible, where storms and solar storms, bad space weather,
so making that connection
cyber
between
attack
them.
Cannot cut off your power. My house is like this. It works with or without the grid. And so, it's a really nice feeling to know that your lights will always be on.
Amory Lovins, I appreciate you ending with that connection between a stable electrical supply and a sustainable one. We have to wrap it up there. Thanks so much, everybody who's called or emailed today on Your Call. Amory Lovins, director of Rocky Mountain Institute. You can see his TED Talk at yourcallradio.org. And you can also learn there about the event he's going to be doing this Sunday night at 6 p.m. at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Amory Lovins, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Is there a right way to use military drones? The Obama administration's expanded use of drones in countries like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia has drawn international criticism. But it's also more popular with Americans than other ways of waging war. On the next Your Call, we'll look at the legal, moral, and strategic implications of using drones to kill your enemies. Is it time to change the drone assassination program or eliminate it? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.